Well, hello and welcome to the latest addition to the Solitaire Rose Podcast Network. That's right, I didn't think that five podcasts was enough. It's me, Corey Strode, host of five podcasts, adding a sixth podcast. Welcome to the Fantastic Forecast.
Hey, welcome everybody.
You'll see that I have a co-host, thank goodness.
With the most.
So you're not going to have to listen to me blather on for, you know, 160. No, I'm sorry. 645 issues. Plus Strange Tales. Plus Marvel 2-in-1. Plus miniseries.
Marvel Team-Up.
Adam Vermillion.
Hello, everyone.
From the late podcast of Panels and Pizza.
R.I.P.
And now with a new podcast coming later this year.
Not going to say the name yet. Because it hasn't officially been announced yet. Hopefully by the time this episode airs, a little bit more information will be out there. But yeah, look for a new show from me coming late October, early November. So if you enjoyed what I did on Panels and Pizza, it's going to be a little bit more of the same, except no pizza, no food angle, no crutch.
No food?
No food. I mean, food is optional. It's going to be a lot of Skype interviews, so if somebody wants to bring pizza on their end, they're welcome to. But have you seen
whoa, stop the clock.
Okay.
Alton Brown's coming back with Good Eats, and you're getting rid of pizza?
Yeah,
This sounds like a conspiracy to me.
I had to clear my plate for him.
Okay.
Pardon the pun. Actually, don't, because they don't get better than that, folks. I was going to say, no more food. I mean, have you seen me lately, Corey? I'm svelte.
Yes.
Do I look like I eat like a ton of pizza anymore? I do. I just run and lift weights a lot.
See, that's how you could do that.
I'm skinny. Much like Mr. Fantastic.
Yes. Although his nickname was not Slim.
No. That would be if we were doing an X-Men podcast.
Yes.
And since I feel like the ultimate podcast of X-Men is already out there with Jay and Miles, Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men. Why bother? So,
and I'm not as deeply in love with the X-Men as I am the Fantastic Four. The Fantastic Four was the first superhero comic I picked up.
I was going to ask you, as this, I know you have a plan for the episode. Should we tell them the name of the show? I don't think we did.
Yeah, I did at the beginning, the Fantastic Forecast.
The Fantastic Forecast. Okay. This is what I know what he deals with a Joe on Crazy Comics and Stories, and I'll try not to be as bad, but I have just been with a 4-year-old for the last 3 days, 3.5 days, so brain's still a little addled. 4-month break. Everything's coming up four, so why not talk Fantastic Four?
Well, this is kind of an offshoot of the series in review that I started a couple of years ago. Which I may just forge ahead on those without Joe, because his schedule's not conducive to continuing it. But you mentioned a new podcast you're doing, and you had a number four, and I said, so, you're doing a Fantastic Four podcast. And Snowball started rolling, and now we have this. My first issue of the Fantastic Four was a reprint. It was Marvel's Greatest Comics, number 57, which starts a second Galactus trilogy in which the Silver Surfer goes to the Microverse. But I did not know at the time that it was a reprint. I was only 11.
Okay, so you thought it was brand new.
Not only did I think it was brand new, but here's this comic, my first superhero comic has Galactus, the Silver Surfer, the Microverse. My brain was blown. And it was months later that I discovered that those were reprint books. So the first issue of the Fantastic Four I bought was another mind blower. It was Fantastic Four 171, written by Roy Thomas, drawn by George Perez, inked by Joe Sinnott, where they fought Gore the Golden Gorilla, who was an emissary who'd been sent by the High Evolutionary from Counter-Earth to let them know that Galactus was coming to eat Counter-Earth.
Oh, not Counter-Earth. No.
So once again, it's like, oh, crap.
I like this already because I feel like I'm a fairly knowledgeable guy when it comes to comics. The Fantastic Four is like this glaring hole in my knowledge. It's like, you know, I know enough the basics, you know, who they are, Galactus, Doctor Doom, you know, all the Rogues Gallery. But when you bring up something like the Golden Gorilla and Counter-Earth, I've never heard of this. And I'm going to hear about it when we get there. But we're a ways off from 171.
So what was the first issue of the Fantastic Four that you bought, and why?
I'm going to two-part answer to this. Part of it's going to be embarrassing. Can I do three?
Sure.
Okay. The first issue of Fantastic Four I remember owning, I believe, was 281. And it's the one that has the cover with Sue Storm in her Malice persona.
Oh, yeah. That was a burn issue.
Yeah, and I didn't know who John Byrne was in 1985 when I got this issue. It came in one of those bundles I got about, like, the Sears Wish Book. So I just remember being like, comic books were like the way I knew that I was attracted to girls. And being like, I like this cover. She's a little scary, but I'm intrigued. So that's the first one I remember having. I don't think I ever read it, maybe flipped through it. And then the first issue of the Fantastic Four I will say that I ever bought was Heroes Reborn.
Okay.
Because of Jim Lee.
Yep.
Because I was still at that age, so that would have been 97. So I was 21 and was still, you know, massive Jim Lee fan from my teenage years. So I remember buying that and sticking through it with all 12 issues of Heroes Reborn, and then jumping into my third part of the answer when they relaunched it with Scott Lobdell writing and Alan Davis on art. And then it became, I think with issue 4, Chris Claremont took over. And I can't remember if Alan Davis stayed on as artist, but I know eventually Carlos Pacheco was in there.
Yep.
And the Claremont run from the late 90s into the early 2000s is actually the only Fantastic Four run that I read and collected, actively collected, because Claremont was writing it. I'm a huge Claremont nerd. So that's pretty much the extent of my Fantastic Four knowledge. And since that was almost 20 years ago now, I barely remember any of it.
Well,
so I'm excited to reread it when we get to that point.
That'll be a ways away, because what we're going to do,
we'll both be retired by then, right?
Retired?
Yeah, what's that?
I'm Generation X. We don't get to retire.
Me too. Barely.
So what we're going to do, we're going to kind of do a DVD commentary for four issues of the Fantastic Four, starting with number one.
Yeah, all the way back to August of 1961, or your cover date of November.
Yes.
So I was going to say, I had a nerdy nitpick with Entertainment Weekly that came out 2 weeks ago with the Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
Because they said, oh, it's the Skrulls, and they first appeared in 1962. And I was like, no, they did not. I was like, that would have been October of 1961. It just had a cover date of 1962. And then I got looked at. So
yeah, and I would have looked at you too, because really, the cover date is what people know.
Yeah, I know. And I try not to be that guy, but every once in a while it sneaks out.
Well, I'm going to be that guy for a while now.
All right, please do. Because the way I'm kind of looking at this, you're looking at it as DVD commentary. I'm looking at it like I'm getting taken to school.
Well, first off, in what format did you read those first four issues?
I have a copy of The Essential Fantastic Four that I was given to by my mentor for my university graduation. So nice and black and white.
I have that as well. I have the Marvel Masterworks. I have the little pocket reprints they did in the late 70s, where they reprinted the first six issues as a paperback book. But I decided to go to the best possible source, my omnibuses.
Were you able to retrieve it without making the Strode compound tilt to one side?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You can also read these on the Marvel Unlimited app.
Oh, excellent. Because we are going to eventually get to the point where I'm going to have to get that.
Yep. Because Essentials, they have stopped printing, and now they're doing them as Epic Collections, which, they were able to keep the trademark and copyright on the word Epic.
They figured out a way.
Well, if you look on those Epic paperbacks, they use the E from the Epic line.
Do they?
Yes.
I haven't gotten any of those yet. I'd like to.
They're nice. I much prefer the Essentials, especially on the 60 stuff, because especially with Ditko, man. Ditko in black and white is beautiful.
Yeah, I have those Spideys, and they look great.
But I want to kind of set the stage for the Fantastic Four.
Please do. Set away.
Because there's a lot of talk when you hear about the early issues of the Fantastic Four, people talk about how historic they were. And without knowing what the comic industry was like, when you go back and read them, they're really crude. The story structure is very different from what you're used to. As we go forward, I'll talk about how under Lee and Kirby, there were kind of three ages of the Fantastic Four. And we're going to be spending a lot of time in the beginning age. Basically, they're putting together the building blocks. But in 1961, comics had kind of weathered a storm, and they weren't exciting anymore. DC had gotten a huge sales bump from The Adventures of Superman. That had settled down, but Superman was still their number one character, and he had 7 comics a month.
No.
Yeah.
Were people complaining then, like they do now, about
no,
too many titles?
No, because it was little kids. You know, you had Action, you had Superman, you had Adventure, which had... I think it was still Superboy and the Legion of Superhero stories. You had Lois Lane had her own book. Jimmy Olsen had his own book. And DC was kind of they were kind of the blue chip stock. You know, Dell was the number one comic book company. And I don't even want to get into how complex Dell was, but Dell had the licenses that still sold the majority of comics. They had the Disney license. They had the Warner Brothers license. They had all the TV licenses. They had all the movie adaptations because they were headquartered out in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And they weren't worried about the comics code. They had a code on their inside front page that says, you know, Dell comics are good comics. And, you know, we make a pledge to parents that our comics will be wholesome, et cetera, et cetera. And they were the number one comics. The estimates are that Walt Disney's Comics and Stories was still selling 1 million copies a month, with most of that through subscriptions. On the other hand, Superman was selling between 500,000 and 750,000 copies a month. So that kind of lets you know what was going on sales-wise. Marvel, if you look on the cover, you don't see Marvel, you just see MC. Right under the comics code.
Yeah, I see that.
And what had happened was, Martin Goodman, who I've talked about on Crazy Comics and Stories, was a total scumbag. In the 30s, he got hauled in front of the courts constantly for passing off reprints in his pulp magazines as new stories and not paying the authors and... Yep, various tax scams. When he started comics, it was Timely Comics, but he always said, that's the distributor. And if you would look in the small print, each comic was printed by a different company. And that was all for tax purposes. In the 50s, they were known as Atlas Comics on the cover. And the reason for that was Goodman had created his own distribution. So he had magazines, paperback books, and comics. The magazines were the kind that men like, and they have a weird name that I still kind of cringe at, but this is what they were called in the industry, Men's Sweat Magazines. And the reason for that was it was girls in lingerie and stories about men being heroic and beating up animals and natives and Nazis and saving helpless women. And if you've ever seen the album cover for Frank Zappa's Weasels Rip My Flesh...
It's been a while, but yes.
That is actually a cover from a Goodman magazine. Where that was the, you know, men's adventure. Weasels Rip My Flesh. The paperback books were Lion Books. What happened was the pulps ran into trouble because TV and everything, but paperback books started selling. So what they would do, they would literally take a pulp magazine, fold it a couple more times, and print it as a paperback book. So you got tons of paperback originals. That's where Mickey Spillane came from. That's where a lot of these 50s crime novels and romance novels and things like that. He had a thriving paperback business, but he had his own distribution. In 1956, he was his own distributor. That's why and people in the industry would still call it Timely. And what he would do, his comic book philosophy was, what's selling? Oh, crank out a shit ton of that. Horror comics are selling. Here's 20 horror comics a month. Westerns are selling. Here's 20 westerns a month. War comics are selling. Here's 20 war comics a month. When Mad Magazine, the comic book became hot, Stan was cranking out a bunch of those. And Stan Lee was the editor. He'd been editor back starting in 42. There was a break during the war. He came back and he was still editor. But in 1956, he signed an agreement with a company called American News Company. They were the number one magazine distributor in the U.S. And like a lot of things in the 50s, corporation bought it up because that's kind of what corporations did back then. You know about how National Periodicals became part of Warner Brothers, right?
Yes. Yeah. Was that in the 70s?
No, it was the 60s.
60s? Okay.
There was a company named Kinney. Now, what do you think Kinney did?
Kinney? More Lad Mags.
No, they owned parking lots.
Well, that makes sense. And they bought lots, publishing.
And they bought Warner Brothers.
Okay.
And then they bought National Periodicals, and they bought all these different companies. Because that's what you did as a corporation back then. Now you buy other companies in your own field to consolidate. But back then, the corporate idea was to diversify. Own a lot of different things in a lot of different places. So a company bought American News Company, and there was a lawsuit. And after they lost the lawsuit, the company that owned them found that the land that American News Company's warehouses were on was worth more than they would make distributing magazines.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So they just shut down their magazine distribution line immediately.
So that put a gigantic dent in Marvel sales.
That killed a lot of things. The only reason Playboy still exists is because back then his subscription sales were high enough, because there were months Playboy wasn't getting to the newsstands. Tons of magazines, tons of book lines, and a lot of comic book publishers just went away because they couldn't get distribution. So over at Independent News, which was owned by National Periodical Publications, which would become DC, Goodman was able to put together a deal with them. They just wanted the magazines and the paperback books, but Goodman pushed for the comics. Now, since National Periodical had DC, they didn't want a lot of competition, so they allowed Goodman to publish 8 books a month.
Wow. Down from, sounds like, about 100.
Yeah.
With war and horror and romance and whatever.
The other thing that did was, Stan was well known in the industry. He had artists, and when you dropped off a story, you got a new one. You dropped off a story, you got a new one. And he had artists who were really fast. Joe Manili could basically crank out a full comic in a week, fully inked.
Like a 20-page comic?
Back then, they were 25.
25? Damn.
25-page inked. He inked his own work. There's a lot of talk about how fast Kirby is. Manili was faster. And if Meneely would have lived, the Marvel Universe would have been vastly different.
I don't know anything about this guy. I've never heard of him.
I talk about him from time to time on the Crazy Comics and Stories. He was Stan's workhorse in the 50s. And the best book out there to see his stuff, in my opinion, is one of the masterworks. It's the Yellow Claw Black Knight masterwork, because he did all the Black Knight stories. And the Yellow Claw was done by Kirby and Al Feldstein, who editor at EC. Well, there was a short time when EC didn't have any work for him, so he came over to Marvel, and Stan gave him work doing that. And then when Mad needed an editor, Feldstein went back to EC, and Kirby did the Yellow Claw. But Marvel had all of these people working all this stuff, and they had a kind of well-known closet filled with art, inventory stories, war stories, romance stories, horror stories, monster stories. Well, when the new distribution deal came through, and rather than publishing however many books they could publish profitably, they were down to 8, everybody got laid off, and Stan used the inventory. Meanwhile, Jack Kirby, who had split from Joe Simon when their publishing company ended, was working at DC. He was doing comics at DC, and he was also doing a comic strip with one of the editors at DC. And Kirby felt that he was not getting his share of the profit from the comic strip, sued the editor for his share of the profits from the comic strip. He lost, and lost his job at DC. Because you don't sue one of the bosses.
It stayed employed.
Yep. And this is where we start to get into some of the myths around Fantastic Four number one. There weren't a lot of publishers out there. Harvey was doing stuff, and he did do some work with Joe Simon on Harvey's superhero line, which didn't really take off. He did a little more work on the Archie superhero line. The design for the Fly was a Kirby design, but he couldn't really land there because there was, you know, there just wasn't enough work. So he came over to Marvel, where Stan had pretty much used up all the inventory and was starting to hire people back. He'd hired Ditko, and he hired Kirby. Kirby said in an interview in 87 that when he came in, they were moving out the furniture, and Stan was crying, "What'll I do? What'll I do?" And Kirby said, "I'll save the company." Well, no one collaborates that. It was pretty much Kirby came over. He didn't want to work for Carlton because Carlton was owned by the mob.
Yep.
He couldn't get work at Dell because you had to be on the West Coast. So Marvel was pretty much it. And Stan put him to work. The horror books had become monster books, and they were selling well. So Kirby started doing monster stuff.
This is on Tales to Astonish, right?
Tales to Astonish, Tales of Suspense, Strange Tales, any of the anthology books. And if you read Fantastic Four number one, you know, you can see that the monster influence is there. Because mm-hmm. that's what was selling.
Now, I was going to ask you about that. Maybe once we start getting into talking about the issue proper, about how this does not feel like it was originally written to be collected in one issue. It felt more like this should have been published in one of those anthologies.
And there are theories about that, but we'll get to that.
All right.
That's foreshadowing. So Marvel wasn't really Marvel. Everybody in the industry still called it Timely. And if you look at those covers, they didn't have a company logo on the cover.
And I noticed
each one was published by a different entity.
Yeah, I flipped through, and it looks like the Marvel logo doesn't show up until issue 14.
Well, they weren't called Marvel Comics till the summer before the Fantastic Four came out. And what it was, they were looking for a name of the company. They were going to try and get kind of a collective identity, because The Fantastic Four, here's another myth I'm going to bust, was not the first Marvel superhero. What?
Oh, I know who it is, but I won't steal your thunder.
Stan thought that superheroes might be coming back. So in one of the anthology books, Amazing Adventures, he had a character named Dr. Droom. And that's a terrible name.
It's horrible.
And it was very much a Doctor Strange prototype, except it was done by Kirby. The Doctor had learned his magic in a Tibetan monastery, used magic to fight monsters. It wasn't even the cover feature in Amazing Adventures, but it was the first kind of continuing character. But to my mind, if you read the comics that were coming out in the late 50s and 1960 by Jack Kirby, the Westerns were set up like superheroes. Two-Gun Kid had a secret identity and, you know, fought bad guys with his amazing power of you know, shooting. Rawhide Kid didn't have a secret identity, but nobody knew his real name. And then we're going to get to the last myth that I'm going to bust. And this is one that Stan Lee spread, and I love Stan. I do. I love Stan. But he says that he has a terrible memory. And it's one of those things where if he told the story enough times, he believed it. So starting in the late 60s, early 70s, Stan started going to college campuses to, you know, lecture about Marvel. And he told a story that Martin Goodman went golfing with the head of DC. And the head of DC said, "We've got this new comic that's selling really, really well. It's the Justice League of America." And Martin Goodman came back to the office and said, "Stan, this Justice League book is selling well. We need to have a superhero team book. Get right on it." I'm going to bust that myth in a few ways. The first is, Martin Goodman was a scumbag. He was known as a scumbag. He was kind of a lowlife, bottom feeder. There is no way in hell that the publisher at DC would go out golfing with him. That would be like, that would be like if Hugh Hefner went out with Larry Flint and they just hung out.
I get that reference.
So what it probably was, based on the stories about Martin Goodman, he had spies. When he ran his own distribution, you know, he would contact other distributors and get lists of what sold. That's how he knew what to publish. I am 99.9% sure, based on how he worked and what people at the time said, that he just kind of had one of his spies give him a list, what's selling. And the number one book at DC was the Justice League. So he came to Stan and said, "We need a superhero team book." And what Martin Goodman suggested is, "Bring back the Timely Heroes. Because, you know, they made us a lot of money in the 40s. Well, Stan remembered that when they brought them back in the 50s, they didn't do well. And the Timely Heroes were the Human Torch, Captain America, and the Submariner. And they brought them back in the 50s, and they'd flopped. They actually published Submariner longer than the others at a loss because there was a TV deal being worked out.
Okay.
And the minute the TV deal died, so did the Submariner comic.
See, I had no idea that any of these books had been brought back.
Yep. And they're available as Masterworks as well. The Atlas Heroes, Volumes 1, 2, and 3, they also have Marvel Boy in those, who doesn't show up in comics till the 70s, but it showed up a few times. Well, we'll get into that. There's so much.
I like it. Who the hell is Marvel Boy?
Marvel Boy became Quasar.
Okay.
And did you read Agents of Atlas?
No.
Marvel
Isn't that,
Boy?
Jeff Parker?
Yep, Marvel Boy was in Agents of Atlas. Marvel Boy was Earth Boy raised on Uranus and then came back to Earth, but because he'd lived on Uranus for so long, he was super advanced, super smart, had the bands and all these powers.
Is that the Nega bands?
Yes.
All right. See, I know some things.
Yeah.
Enough to be dangerous.
Then Stan sat down, and we do not know if he had a story conference with Jack Kirby or he just wrote it up, but we do know that the plot for Fantastic Four number one exists in its typewritten form, because Stan, when Roy Thomas started working at Marvel, Stan showed it to him.
No, I thought that this was the whole thing where they were going under and Stan wanted to quit. And his wife was like, write the story you want to write. And that was the Fantastic Four number one. At least that's the documentary I saw and heard.
And that's the story Stan has told. Marvel was not going under. Goodman was always trying to sneak out a ninth book and a tenth book and trying to sneak his way out because the comics were selling. They weren't selling great, but they were profitable. Stan had been working at, you know, the Marvel Comics line, the Timely line, since 1942.
God.
And think about that. It's 20 years. You know, you've had to fire everybody twice. Because he had to do it in 1949, and he had to do it again in 1956. He's cranking out stories for kids. Now, through Goodman, Stan was doing other stuff. Stan always said, oh, I wanted to write the great American novel. Stan was never somebody who wrote novels. He had the opportunity to write through Goodman. And what he did, he had a few comic strips, one of which he did with Joe Manili, called Ms. Lion and Her Cubs. There's that Ms. Lion name.
Ms. Lion, yeah.
Which he and Manili actually went and got approval from the Cub Scouts. And it was kind of a licensed strip, except he really didn't know anything about Cub Scouts, and they were always yelling at him, hey, Cub Scouts don't do that. he tried a Willie Lumpkin strip, which failed. He did a romance strip, and the name of it I cannot remember off the top of my head. But he was also doing joke books. And there was a thing in the 60s where they would take publicity stills and news photos and stuff and put funny dialogue with them. It was kind of the first memes. And Stan had done a few of those. He didn't lose money because they did more of them. He did one about golf, he did one about the political figures, and it was something that he liked doing to the point where he, actually Marvel had a magazine in the 70s that ran for 3 issues where he did it with photos of old monster movies.
Okay. None of this sounds very interesting.
they're not. He had to come up with a new book, and here are the other books that Marvel were publishing at the time. Most of these were bi-monthly, because remember, they could only put out 8 books a month.
Okay, yeah.
There was Amazing Adventures, which became Amazing Adult Fantasy, which became Amazing Fantasy before it was canceled. And Amazing Adventures was kind of a monster book. It had Dr. Droom in it. When it became Amazing Adult Fantasy, it was just Lee and Ditko doing twist-ending stories. There was The Rawhide Kid, which was a Western. Tales to Astonish, Tales of Suspense, Journey into Mystery, Strange Tales, Gunsmoke Western.
Never heard of that one.
Kathy, which was kind of a soap opera romance comic thing. Millie the Model. And Millie the Model actually sold well because there was also a second Millie comic called Life with Millie. Patsy Walker.
Ah, Patsy.
Which also sold well enough that there was a second comic, Patsy and Hetty, because her friend was Hetty, and Two Gun Kid. So Marvel was doing monsters and romance comics, kind of with an Archie bent, and westerns. So they started a superhero book, and while Stan was told, bring back the timely heroes, he only brought one back. And we get the first issue of The Fantastic Four. So that's kind of the world that led up to this. And what Stan has said is his wife told him, you know, write the book you want to write. And I don't doubt that at all. But if you read the first issue and you know that Marvel was publishing a lot of monster books, if you look at the cover, it's 4 people fighting a big monster.
Yeah.
So he was kind of going for what was already there. And the Human Torch is center of the page because the Human Torch was one of their most popular characters back in the 40s. But there you go.
But this is not that Human Torch.
No, it's not. This is a new Human Torch. And some people have said that this is just the Challengers of the Unknown with superpowers. There are differences, and the Fantastic Four is more of a family. But we're going to get to the first issue now. Now, this comic has been reprinted so many times that as I read it, I could almost say it verbatim. It starts with a splash page showing our four characters, Dr. Reed Richards, Ben Grimm, Susan Storm, and Johnny Storm. And we have no idea who these people are and what they have to do with the people on the cover. By the way, I do like Fantastic Four featuring The Thing, Mr. Fantastic, Human Torch, Invisible Girl, together for the first time!
For the first time! Yes!
Well, that's probably, you know, the whole Justice League thing where, well, people want to read, they feel they're going to get more than their money's worth if there are four heroes in a book.
Yes, but it's also the first time that anyone's ever seen any of these characters.
And another thing I want to talk about story-wise is this book is broken up into chapters.
Yes, and that's where I started thinking, was this created for one of those anthologies that you were talking about?
There are people who say it might have been, except for the fact that the plot of the first issue has it written like this. I think one of the reasons they do it in chapters is because people back then in their comics were used to getting more than one story.
Okay.
You know, in the Superman books, there were usually three stories. In the Batman books, there were usually three stories. You had two with the hero and one backup story. You know, if the issue just had one story in it, they would actually call it novel length, but they would still break it into chapters. So this one is broken into chapters. There is a theory floating out there that the Fantastic Four Meet the Mole Man might have been thought of as being in an anthology book. And there are bits in the script that seem to do that as well. But we start with the Fantastic Four being signaled by a mysterious man in a skyscraper. And
in Central City, of all places.
Yes, this is not New York. This is Central City, which was retroactively placed in California.
Okay. Ah, I did not know that.
Another thing I want to point out is, up by the four characters, you have Stan Lee and Jack Kirby.
Yeah, I see that.
For the longest time, we did not know who inked this book.
Do we know now?
We are mostly sure that it was inked by George Klein, who was inking at Marvel. And there was actually, I was on the Timely Atlas Yahoo discussion list when they were studying this. This took years. For the longest time, they thought it was Chris Rule, who had done some other inking at Marvel. But Doc Vassalero, who is a comic historian and has written tons of introductions to the older masterworks from the 50s, pretty much proved to everybody involved that it was George Klein by pointing out George Klein inks this way and he does this, to the point where in the omnibus they credit George Klein.
Okay, so they're pretty certain.
Yep, but there are no records. And this was back before they were putting credits in comics. There will be quite a few issues where they don't have credits in the comics when you're reading the Fantastic Four. But we get a two-page sequence introducing the Invisible Girl. And then we get the Thing, who's trying to buy clothes, introduced as a monster. And if you read his dialogue, he sounds like a comic book villain.
Oh, yeah. And that was another thing that made me question whether or not this had been written for an anthology, is because the Thing's dialogue, his patterns of speech drastically change between chapter one and chapter two.
Yeah.
And I know that Byrne did, I think it was a Marvel team-up, or a two-in-one?
Two-in-one, number 50.
Where the Thing goes back in time to this, like, point, and
yes,
kind of addresses that. So I thought that was kind of neat. I know Byrne always does things like that. But just to go back and read it, now having that bit of knowledge, really made it glaring with the way Ben is written between this first chapter and the second chapter. Because I feel like the second chapter really starts getting that that cadence and that speech pattern down that we know of as, you know, the Thing, you know, the way he normally speaks. But this first chapter, it's just like, what the hell is going on here?
And he's drawn like one of the Marvel monsters.
Yeah, he's doesn't look like a hero whatsoever.
No. Another thing about these early sequences. It ties back to kind of how Timely had their heroes. You know, the Submariner was not really a hero. He just kind of worked with the surface world because he hated the Nazis. But in his early appearances, and then after World War II, he was fighting humanity. Timely's heroes were always outsiders. They were misanthropes. They weren't people you admired. The Human Torch, in his early appearances, couldn't control his flame, so they were always having to lock him away for the safety of others. Captain America was kind of their only goody-two-shoes, but a lot of the Timely heroes lived outside the law, were thought of as villains, were really kind of bastards. You know, they had no problem killing people, throwing them off buildings, etc., because that's what the heroes were like in the pulps. If you ever read a Spider novel, the body count is shocking. The Shadow. What's his power? Well, he can cloud men's minds, and he's got a couple of 45s that he kills people with. Now, with the Comics Code, you couldn't really have heroes like that. But here they're pushing that envelope for the thing because the monster book sold so well, and it gave the team a different dynamic. This was at a time when, if you read the Justice League, not only did everybody talk alike, but they were all best friends and had been best friends since the dawn of time. Here, this guy's tearing up the street, destroying cars, scaring the populace.
And I think, you know, if you were a kid in 1961 and you're reading this, it's just got to be awesome.
Yeah.
To see this guy just kind of letting loose. He's like, oh, this is one of the main guys, one of the heroes of the group, and he's ripping up the street and jumping down in the sewer. And
and the cops are after him.
Yeah. It's like, what's going on here?
Then we get the introduction of the Human Torch in a characterization that really carries through the first big batch of the Fantastic Four, the first act of the Fantastic Four. Johnny Storm is hanging out with his pals. He's working on a car. And, look, we're being signaled. And then rather than stepping out of the garage, nope, Kirby wants to show what his powers are. He lights himself on flame, melts the car, and takes off into the sky.
And I like that you bring up he wants to show what the powers are. And so I feel like, kind of in character with Johnny, but with all of these folks, the entire Fantastic Four, there aren't any secret identities.
No.
It's like done away with. And it's just like, here we are, you know who we are, but we're a team of superheroes.
Well, in this first issue, nobody knows who they are. Everybody's shocked that they exist.
Well, Johnny's buddy definitely knows who he is now.
Yeah. But then on page 7, this is the one sequence where back as a kid, I went, what? Human Torch is melting planes, but of course he's making sure that everybody gets out of them. But they fire a nuclear missile at him. They fire a nuclear warhead at him over the city. Reed Richards stretches to grab the missile, and he just throws it in the ocean. Where it explodes harmlessly. But we also see that the Human Torch has a limited amount of flame. But within 8 pages, we've been introduced to everyone and we've seen their powers.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that Kirby does through his entire run is he tries very early, sometimes just on the splash page, to show the characters using their powers, to introduce you. This is what these people do. And then we get the origin of the Fantastic Four.
Oh, classic.
It's been retold hundreds and hundreds of times. And even as a kid, again, I went, what? Reed Richards has designed and, well, he says here he built it, but he just designed our missile to go to the moon so we could beat the Ruskies. He decides that the government's moving too slow, so he gets his best friend, who's a test pilot, his girlfriend and her kid brother to steal the missile.
I love it. It's showing some initiative.
Yes. And they just sneak past the guard.
Yeah.
Guard doesn't notice them.
No. And I love Johnny's reason for going. It says, and I'm tagging along with Sis. So it's settled. And nobody says a word.
Now, in this story, they're just trying to go into space because man had not made it to space yet. Later on, it would be they were trying to beat the Russians to the moon. By the time Byrne retold the story, it was an experimental warp drive. They keep updating it.
Right, right. And that probably has to do with that the sliding timeline, correct? The Marvel sliding timeline.
Yes, which actually was created by Byrne.
Oh, I love Byrne.
Byrne said when he did the Fantastic Four that their first story was 8 years ago. They're now to 15 years ago. So, and it all stems from the Fantastic Four. So the Fantastic Four went into space after 9/11.
Where nobody's really going into space anymore. one thing I wanted to point out with, I feel like you bring up this story has been like reprinted, retold so many times. I feel like it's up there, at least for me, maybe others, you know, with the origin of Batman, with the origin of Spider-Man, where I can't tell you the first time I ever heard any of these things. I feel like I was just born with this knowledge, that it was gained through, like, cultural osmosis. Know it.
And every so often, you know, when a new creator comes on to the Fantastic Four, especially in the 70s, when a new creator comes on, they retell the story. Because this is kind of the origin point. And what it is, they're up in space. Reed screwed up, didn't have good enough shielding for the cosmic rays. They're battered with cosmic rays. And they crash land on Earth. They've stolen a missile, gone into space, landed, nobody knows where they are, but this is when they crash land, they get out of the missile and their powers first start to appear.
It's, pardon the pun, fantastic. I love it. I'm looking at the pages right now and it's just, it's so great. It's so classic. It's the formation of this team and really, Corey, it's the beginning of the Marvel Universe as we know it.
When Ben Grimm becomes the Thing, he lashes out at the others. Everybody's kind of freaked out by their powers. Whereas, you know, in older stories, you know, especially in the 40s, when somebody got their powers, it's, oh, look, I gave myself a transfusion with mongoose blood, and now I can move really fast.
The Wizard!
Or, you know, the Flash, you know, DC's Flash, where it's, oh, the lightning hit these chemicals, and now I can run really fast. He's not freaked out by it. He's like, oh, cool.
Yeah, it works.
These guys are kind of freaked out by it.
Yeah, they're having a very human reaction, a very realistic reaction to
and
this.
And this was, because this was different, I always kind of look at it as, you know, before the Fantastic Four, your heroes were very one-dimensional. The Fantastic Four, with the story, gave us characters who are two-dimensional. And it starts what Marvel was known for, heroes with problems. You know, Superman didn't have a problem. His only problem was if somebody got a hold of Kryptonite or that wacky Lois Lane trying to prove that Clark Kent's Superman, the Thing is a monster. They don't get along. But they decide in, I think page 13 is the sequence I've seen the most.
Yes.
Where we've changed. All of us were more than just human, and they have to use their power to help mankind.
And then I hear a Norm MacDonald's voice, and I'm Mr. Fantastic.
Well, they can use Plastic Man.
No, they could not. jumping off, and that might be what I do. Maybe that's my role in this show as we build this show ourselves. Do you think that when Stan and Jack were creating this, that they were even cognizant of the fact that they were, like, creating these characters that are, like, representations of the four elements?
No. Jack was asked about that, and it was very much about, okay, well, we're going to have the Human Torch, we need a monster, and they were looking for powers for Sue and Reed. The other thing is that they were all related in some way.
Yes.
And usually the super team, they weren't connected in, but the Fantastic Four really kind of melded together. And we learn later on that Ben was Reed's best friend in college, and, you know, Reed and Sue had been together since then, and, and all of these things. Remember how he brought them together for a crisis?
With a flare gun.
You turn the page and there you go, there's a monster. And as you said, there are theories that this was going to be, you know, kind of the front of an anthology book, but they got their own book instead. This reads like a second story, but it is melded with the first story. So I think this was just Stan's way of, okay, we're going to give you more than one story, but it's just one story. So they are at a place. They don't have a headquarters. They don't. It's just, nope. Reed's got pictures of stuff going on in the news. That nuclear power plants are being grabbed by something.
Something's pulling them under.
And it's very much, if you read the Marvel Monster stories of the time, it follows that story sequence almost to a T. Where it's the mysterious things are happening. We then find out that it's a monster of some kind. Everybody's freaked out. Another thing I found interesting was the monster is being controlled by the Mole Man.
Yes.
But in the rest of the story, he's just called the Mole.
I didn't pick up on that. Yeah, he calls himself the Mole Man on page 19.
I am the Mole Man. And then page 23. We'll see about that, Mole. But Reed figures out pretty quickly. By studying the cave-ins carefully, I've pinpointed the island located exactly between them, and that is where we'll find our answer. It's known as Monster Isle.
There's nothing ominous about that.
Well, and also, they're not taking a lot of time.
No. And now, you know, almost 60 years later, this first issue would have been 5 to 6 issues to set up.
Yes. But they go to Monster Isle in their plane. Nobody knows about them. But they have a plane. But they go to Monster Isle, where we get a three-headed, what looks like Ghidra. You get Mr. Fantastic using his powers, showing that he can be good for something, too. Everybody has to show that they're good for something. Because, well, Mr. Fantastic can stretch. Why does that matter? We have to show why that's important.
It's like it strangled the hell out of this monster. All right.
Yeah. And, you know, he could be used as a parachute, even though Johnny Storm could flame on.
Yeah, but right still, now, maybe he used it already. Because we're still dealing with limited flame.
And it's also to show these characters' powers.
Yeah.
Rather than tell you, they show you. And it's one of the things that is really important in these early issues, because every, you know, Stan believed every issue was somebody's first. You have to show the characters using their powers. You have to give a reason why you should root for these guys. And we're introduced to the Mole Man as Reed and Johnny are in special suits because the glare from the Valley of Diamonds would blind them. And then we get Sue Storm and Ben Grimm versus a monster. Basically, we get an unveiling of the thing again. His costume was basically a trench coat and a hat.
And glasses.
Yep.
I love it.
But we get another action sequence here showing the thing's power. And then the Mole Man gives his origin story. And rather than most villains who, well, I'm a bad guy because I'm a bad guy because, you know, I'm bad. The Mole Man has a tragic past. Another part of the Marvel storytelling style where the villains have personality. It's not like, I hate Superboy because he made me bald.
Right, right. And this is why I've always been more of a Marvel guy than a DC guy. Because I've never been able to relate to the DC characters because of that. And I know that's changed over, you know, the course of time. But, you know, when I started getting into comics in the 80s, you know, my exposure to both, you know, the DC and Marvel was more through cartoons than comics at first.
Yeah.
And the DC, like the Super Friends and stuff, was very much that. You know, I knew that Luthor hated Superboy because his lab exploded and made all of his hair fall out.
And, you know, Batman's villains, even into, I would say at least till the 70s, they were just bad guys. And the Flash, his villains were just criminals. You know, they didn't have elaborate backstories. It's, no, well, each one had a special power, and they were criminals. They robbed banks. You know, they robbed jewelry stores. That's what they did. But the Mole Man has created this underground world where he is the king, whereas on the surface world, he was a joke, he was deformed, he, you know, was hated and mocked. You know, he has a plan to pretty much take over every major city, every atomic plant, and then he will attack and destroy anything that lives above the surface. And they stop him by running away. To be blunt, it really feels like, you know, the story structure is like, ah, crap, we only have 2 pages.
What do we do?
Because, you know, on the next to last page, the Mole Man brings up his biggest, scariest monster. Do they fight the biggest, scariest monster? No, they just kind of run away from it.
Human Torch warms up the room and
causes a rock slide.
Yep. You're right, I didn't really pick up on that reading through this, but what starts out like really great and strong story-wise, it just kind of fizzles.
Yeah, they create a rock slide to trap the monsters underneath, and the Mole Man blows himself up. But here's the thing, there's so much in this comic. There's so much. Kirby's artwork already... vibrant, kinetic, there's action. If you look at other comics of the time, characters all look very stiff and posed. Kirby's figures always look like they're in motion. Always. They're running, they're jumping, they're leaping, they're doing things.
Yeah, even just when the characters are standing, you know, he figures out like a really interesting angle on which
yes.
to present the panel in, and yeah, you're right. It's always something in each panel. There's something to grab your eye. There's something to draw you through the page and keep you going. And
even the panels that are establishment panels, you know, the panel with the soldier standing there, it's a smaller panel, and the next panel is the soldier dealing with the earthquake, and then after that, you know, the ground falls out from under him. He's setting the tone to show what's going to happen. Kirby had been drawing comics for over 20 years at this point. Stan had been writing comics for 20 years at this point. These two guys knew what they were doing.
Oh,
Stan,
yeah.
Now, Stan was basically, the stuff he signed was the stuff he wrote in the 50s. He liked the soap opera stuff, like the modeling with Millie and the Patsy Walker. He liked the joke stuff, and he loved the old corny jokes. He didn't do a lot of the monster stuff until he had to. One other thing I want to bring up. We're not going to dwell on it a lot, but was Stan the writer? Stan was the editor-in-chief of Marvel. And editors back then were very different from what we think of as an editor now. Over at DC, you had the editors. The writers would come in and pitch stories, and the editor would take them or not, but the editor would also give you a story. Mort Weisinger always... was doing that. He was, nope, we're going to do a story where Superman does this. Here you go. There's the plot. I want you to write it.
Stan
was the guy who did the scripting at Marvel, but he also did the editorial where he would bring in the artist and go, okay, here's the story. Here's what we're doing. I'm going to type up a story synopsis. Here you go. Then when he got it back, he would script it. And the reason he would do that was because he was the editor. He was running the company, and he had to write pretty much all the books because Martin Goodman was too cheap to let him hire another writer. He was able to let his brother write some stuff if his brother was also drawing stuff. He had scripters come in now and then, but for the most part, Stan wrote because he didn't have money to hire other writers. So the whole, well, Stan, the way Stan did his stories was putting a lot of the onus on the artists. Well, other editors did that too. They just had a writer that they hired to, you know, do this the panel by panel scripting for the artist. Stan brought in people who could do that. He paid them as well as he could because, you know, Martin Goodman, again, penny pinching scumbag. And Marvel's books, you know, Superman was selling 250,000 copies. Marvel stuff was selling 200,000 copies at a dime each. that's my take on the whole Stan Jack thing.
Yeah. I've always been of the school of thought of I don't care. I'm just glad that this book got made. So by the time I got into comics, that all this stuff was there waiting for me. Because I think back to it's so weird because I don't ever want to think of what my life would have been like without comic books. And I think about things like Action Comics number one and Fantastic Four number one, Amazing Fantasy 15, you know, these foundations that we're building towards you being born, me being born, finding this stuff, and how much it's like meant to us over our lives. So when it comes down to did Jack write more, did Stan write more, who did more of what? It's like at the end of the day, I don't care. I am just so happy it's here.
And me talking to a lot of people who worked, you know, I've talked to a few people from the Golden Age. I've talked to a lot of people who worked in the Silver Age. It was a job.
Yeah, they never expected, like, 50-some years later that you and I are sitting down talking about this stuff and dissecting it.
Let me put it this way. Adam, 17 years ago, you were working on a spreadsheet. Tell me about that spreadsheet.
Oh, Christ. Oh, yeah, when you put it that way, there were numbers on it.
Did you put all the numbers on there, or did somebody give you the numbers to put in it?
Bit of both.
When you sent it to your boss, did he make changes to it? Did he tell you to make changes to it? Did they give it to somebody else to add information to it, to create graphs? We look at this stuff as art. And now it's put together like that. But back then, again, remember, they didn't even know who inked the first two issues. They had no idea. The only reason we know what Dick Ayers did at Marvel is because he had obsessive compulsive disorder and kept track of every story he did. He would write the job number, the comic it was in, and how much he got paid for it.
Okay. Hey, that
for his whole life.
That makes me think, is that what those little V's are? Like V-372? I have never known what those were.
That is the job number.
Okay.
So that it could be billed properly.
Okay. Gotcha.
When you turned in your pay voucher, it would be, I did story thus and such.
Okay.
Which is why, again, the whole the Fantastic Four was going to be in an anthology. There are no missing numbers, and there's only one job number for the whole book.
I see that now. So that ties it all together. Yeah, the V-372.
Okay. The thing that Doc Vassalero has done, because he's trying to get a complete collection of every Atlas book and Marvel book up to a certain period, he's tracking all the job numbers so that he can say, oh, this was an inventory story that was done 2 years earlier.
I'm so happy there are people out there who care about stuff like that so that I can just read it once their hard work's all been finished.
And through the 90s and 2000s, I was on that list, and you know, everybody says, gee, Corey, you know a lot about comics. No, I just read all these brilliant people who did all this research and absorbed it. And by the way, it's all still out there, so if you ever want to learn all this stuff, you know, a lot of it's getting into Alter Ego magazine and back issue. But if you want to read the actual emails of people batting this around, go to the Timely Atlas list at Yahoo Groups.
Gotcha.
Well, see, they're still there.
That's why I was like, I want to do a show with Corey when the whole thing was like a Fantastic Four podcast. And even though the other show I'm doing is not a Fantastic Four podcast, it just, like you said at the beginning, the snowball started. You know, I'm a big believer, you know, when you listen to Kevin Smith speak and he speaks about, you know, chasing whimsy and why not? And I just say, why not? This will be fun. Let's do it. Corey knows shit ton and more about comics than I could ever hope to know, so I'm going
to... And you get to read the Fantastic Four!
I know, which is something that I've always wanted to do and have never done, so it's just... It all made sense.
Well, the second issue of the Fantastic Four, they're fighting the Skrulls.
The Skrulls from outer space!
Second issue, they introduce a new alien race.
Oh, God, you know, in 1961, they had no idea that the Skrulls were going to become such a major player in the Marvel Universe. You know that when they were writing this issue. It was like, we just need aliens. Oh, yeah.
Because this issue has its share of goofiness as well. But we start off, what is happening? What is happening here? What is the thing doing? Swimming toward this offshore, swimming miles offshore toward the lonely Texas Tower. Why do his eyes gleam with a sinister, crafty light? Silently, powerfully, he swims closer, closer, hidden by the deepening twilight. Unseen, unsuspected, he swims toward one of the tower's mighty support posts. And then the thing just rips it down and destroys this oil tank, oil rig.
Oh, I love it.
This is our second issue.
Yeah.
The thing was kind of a jerk last issue and destructive, and we start out with him doing this.
And it very well could be him, based on that first issue.
And in the second, we see Sue Richards stealing a diamond. And then the Human Torch.
Wow, he would fit in this day and age now, wouldn't he?
This priceless statue took 5 years to carve out of solid marble, and the Human Torch melts it. And Mr. Fantastic, he just reaches in the power plant and turns out the power.
It's like, look at what we've done, all these heinous crimes. I'm going to flip a switch. No, I do like this because, I mean, on page three, we do find out that these are not the real Fantastic Four. These are the Skrulls, the shape-shifting Skrulls, which this would cause so much trouble throughout the years in the Marvel Universe. But it is kind of cool to see. God, I love going back through and reading these with more of a critical eye on my first read and second read, you know, picking this stuff up, getting kind of a glimpse to see what if, you know, the Fantastic Four had decided not to stay good people. Here are the things we could have done with our powers.
And not only that, it sets the tone. This is their second appearance. Their first appearance, nobody knew who they were. This appearance, they're villains. You know, the newspapers are saying they're villains. Which would carry on with Marvel as a theme. Spider-Man being hunted by the cops. Luke Cage being hunted by the cops. Heroes as outsiders. Yeah. Where the hated and feared by the outside world.
Yeah, I'm in Bendis's Daredevil run right now, and the whole thing where he's been outed by the tabloids and, you know, in fighting against that. So, yeah, it's something that continues to this day.
And, you know, DC did not do stories like this because partly I think it just wasn't in their DNA, but partly because they were scared that the comics code would go, wait a minute, you can't do a story about a villain as the hero. Then you're doing a crime comic, and crime comics were forbidden by the comics code.
Oh, no, not crime.
Fantastic Four are actually on vacation, read in a flannel suit as they're up at their hunting lodge. But here's the difference. The Thing hears about it and goes berserk.
Yeah.
Starts just losing his mind. The Thing was volatile. He was dangerous. He was a monster.
He wasn't calm and cool and collected like your heroes back then would have been.
And also, you know, what he says, he's kind of the, I don't want to say the pity character, but he's the character who shows not only is he outwardly a monster, but he's got that sort of Frankenstein thing where, you know, it's all right for the Torch. At least you're human. But how would you like to be me? I won't wait any longer. I'm going out to fight, to smash. And in the early issues, that's who he was. He was barely under control. He was angry at the world. Again, the story's divided into chapters. The second chapter starts, the army has shown up to take the Fantastic Four prisoner.
Yeah, and this was more of me questioning, how was this going to be more for an anthology? It's like, did they write all of this thinking it was going to be broken up in parts over a couple of different magazines and something happened and then it got chucked together into one issue? But again, now that you've pointed out the job code, that doesn't look to be the case.
I've heard that theory before, and to me it doesn't quite hold water, especially when you look at what they did with Dr. Droom. They didn't even cover feature it. It wasn't successful, and after a few stories, they let it fade. Whereas, you know, especially if it was, Justice League selling. We need a book of superhero team. But again, we get another sequence where the characters show off their powers. They're imprisoned, and they use their powers to get free. Sue turns invisible so that the military thinks she's gone. Johnny Storm finds a vent that he can melt. The thing smashes the same place over and over and over, and Reed Richards looks for a loose rivet that he can squeeze out of. And on the next page, when his head squeezes out, that's still really disturbing.
It's very disturbing. But I love it because it's like, this is how small this dude can make himself.
Well, you know what they say about cats. If they can get their head into something because their shoulders dislocate, they can get into anything that their head can get into. So,
yeah, that is just a goofy. It's disturbing and goofy, and I love it.
But the Fantastic Four, they escape, and they decide what they're going to do. They're going to have Johnny Storm infiltrate the Skrulls. And there's a new rocket to be tested. If you also look, the Daily Globe is the newspaper. 2 years from then, it would be the Bugle because Stan wanted everything to connect.
Okay.
But they just kind of, you know, they weren't thinking universe yet.
No. And you can tell. I mean, this is just, they're just telling stories right now. They're not aware that they're setting something up, something much, much larger.
And also, we get a bunch of sequences in the story of the Human Torch and the Thing fighting. And later on, it would be playful teasing, but here, it's pure hate.
Yeah.
Ben hates the Torch. And, you know, Torch acts like a snotty 16-year-old. He's going to keep egging him on.
And you know, Ben probably just, when he was still human, in human form, probably just took this kid with a grain of salt. He was just irritating. But man, now that he's pissed off at the world, and then he sees this good-looking cat like Johnny. Ooh.
Well, and think about, you know, you haven't had a teenager in your life in a while.
Not since I was one.
But teenagers are annoying as hell. So good luck with that.
Okay, yeah, because, yeah, thank you.
But Johnny infiltrates the Skrulls by just melting the platform for the missile and getting in their car.
It's just that simple, folks.
That sequence is one page. It's one page where he infiltrates them. And there were four Skrulls earlier. Now there's only three. So he gets taken to where the Skrulls are hiding. He sends the signal, and the fight begins.
Yeah, he really lucked out that the Human Torch imposter Skrull just happened to not be there. Wonder how that worked.
Well, no, if you turn, one of the other Skrulls uses the Human Torch powers.
Oh, yeah, he does. Okay.
And again, we see Johnny can't stay flamed on for very long. They've given a limit to his power. None of the other characters have a limit to their power, but the Human Torch does.
That's so weird. It just seems so arbitrary right now.
And the fight sequence takes 2 pages.
Yeah.
Very different from what Kirby would be doing later. But again, they have to restrain the Thing from beating the shit out of them. So they go to the Skrull's spaceship, which is carefully disguised as a water tower.
And I love that because the water towers, I mean, have they moved to New York City yet? Because
no.
The water towers feel so, it's so Marvel New York.
Yes. How did they stop the invasion, Adam? The Skrull mothership is above the Earth. They've been planning this for years to invade. They've got their armada ready to go.
Well, they give them...
Reed Richards stops them.
They give them clippings of monsters from Strange Tales and Journey into Mystery.
Again, I first read this story when I was about, 79, so I was 14. And I went, no. By the way, Byrne later explained this by saying that Skrulls have bad eyesight.
Oh, jeez.
Or was it Roy Thomas? Roy Thomas might have done that. Skrulls have bad eyesight.
I mean, if the foiling of the villains can be that goofy, then the explanation can be that goofy, I suppose. It's comics. It all flies.
They return to Earth, and they have to go through the cosmic rays again.
Yes.
And everybody else is fine with it, but the Thing freaks out and reverts back to being Ben Grimm. And this is a theme that would happen through the early issues, where something would happen and he would be Ben Grimm, and you know, just so happy he's no longer a monster, but it would be temporary. It wouldn't last. And Reed would promise to figure out how to cure him.
What a tease for the readers. I mean, geez.
Yeah.
Oh, God. And just putting this character through that as well.
And they are arrested again. And Reed Richards convinces him to take him to where the Skrulls are. And, of course, the Skrulls attack as monsters because we've got to have monsters. They're beaten, and the three Skrulls, the way they get rid of the three Skrulls is not to imprison them, not to lock them up.
They turn them into cows.
But they are hypnotized and made into cows.
Which didn't Byrne undo this as well?
Other people have done it.
Okay.
Because Byrne did a story where the Skrulls were milked. And the Skrull milk caused people to freak out. And if you've read Skrull Kill Crew, the Skrull calves had been made into hamburger.
Oh my God, no. No.
Yes.
Oh, this is awesome.
But another thing is, where's the fourth Skrull? Oh, he went back with the others. We don't know that.
So there's a storyline just still sitting there waiting to be mined?
Yes, okay. And it is mined later on in the Kree-Skrull War.
Oh, okay, wow. So over in Avengers.
Yep.
Okay.
But we also get a pin-up on the next page.
That's where I was pulling that from. Not Byrne, but the Kree-Skrull War.
We get a pin-up, first in a series, now, Fantastic Four pin-up page.
My copy
with
does
a different
not have
job
that,
number.
So.
Ah. And then at the bottom of that pinup page, it says, "Don't miss Amazing Adult Fantasy Comics on sale now."
Ooh, what could ever happen in that?
And that was the one that Lee and Ditko did, and Lee was pretty proud of that. He thought that he and Ditko were doing great work on that book. It's also, you know, they put the ad kind of bumper at the bottom. This is something that Marvel does all the way up through the 70s. And I haven't read it in the Essentials in a while. So when we get to issue four, they have bumpers. But next is issue three.
Oh, God.
With issue three, this is the greatest comic magazine in the world. And they would have that as part of the logo from then on.
Yeah.
The world's greatest comic magazine.
It is so wonderful. I love it. It's just there. It's just like throwing down the gauntlet.
And they don't show the villain on this cover. It's, hey, the Fantastic Four have a new car.
And costumes.
And costumes and a skyscraper hideout.
And new car, costumes, hideout is the best thing about issue three.
Yeah. When Kirby was working over at DC, he was, you know, doing the New Gods and stuff, and Vince Coletta was inking him. And there was one time he asked, well, what are they doing over at Marvel on Fantastic Four? And he said, well, you know, they just brought back the Miracle Man. And he went, Miracle Man? Ugh, that was one of the dumbest characters we ever created. But here he is, the menace of the Miracle Man. He is a stage magician.
It's such a, like, decline from Alien Invaders.
Although, they still use the monsters in this issue.
That's true, they do.
But I like in the first page, it's, okay, we have celebrities in the audience. And there we go, we get our introduction there. First is Reed Richards, better known as Mr. Fantastic. Next to him, fully visible, is the so-called Invisible Girl. On her left, we find the Thing. And the youngest member of the Fantastic Four, known to the world as the Human Torch. They introduce the characters, boom, right there as part of the story.
Right there.
Stan was a master at making sure, here you go, you need to know who these characters are.
And you get a little bit of who the Miracle Man is.
Yep. You know what? So the Miracle Man is showing off his powers with his stage show. He can basically do anything.
I want to know his assistant story. I'm looking at her and I'm interested. Do they ever bring her back? Does this dude ever
Not that
even
I'm
show
aware
up
of. I don't even think she shows up in this story again.
But does the Miracle Man ever show up again? Like later?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, he shows up in Roy Thomas brings him back.
Okay.
In the 120s.
All right. Oh, we're...
That's why, you know, when they told Jack, yeah, they're using Miracle Man. Ugh, hated that character. He was stupid. But we get the Thing trying to smash through a giant piece of wood.
He has
to work hard at it while the Miracle Man is able to break it in half with his finger. The Fantastic Four are in the Fantasticar with no introduction or anything. That's how they leave the stage show.
Well, it got introduced on the cover.
Right. But then we get the introduction to their new headquarters with a cutaway showing what's there. This was kind of very standard for comics in the 50s and 60s, where it's everybody had to have a headquarters.
And I love this kind of stuff, because it's so, like, stuff that kids do. Here's my headquarters, and this is all the cool stuff I would have in it.
They got the pogo plane, the Fantastic Copter, the Fantastic Car. They've got a long-range passenger missile, can reach any part of the world in minutes.
Yes, got to know that. That's an important detail. Minutes.
But I also like where it says, save this for future reference. Because this was back when people just threw away their funny books.
You clip that out and put it on your wall.
There you go. Our next part is a monster movie is opening. We get the Fantastic Four costumes, and let's face it, the Thing hates his. And he should. It's a terrible costume. He's got a hood.
But that helmet gets brought back.
Yes.
Like, way later.
But he hated it. But the Miracle Man is able to make the giant papier-mâché monster outside the theater come to life. So we get our monster.
Yep, there he is.
I, the Miracle Man, declare war on the whole human race.
I intend to conquer the Earth. This is one of those things I've always wondered about, you know, these, like, supervillain plots about taking over the entire planet. Do you really think that there's, like, some village in Sri Lanka that gives a shit?
But Miracle Man does not have a tragic backstory. He's just a megalomaniacal villain.
And that's why this is boring.
And it's probably why he didn't come back much. But Reed Richards is able to stop the giant monster by stretching himself to the limit between... Basically, he makes a web between buildings, and then the Miracle Man knocks him out by throwing a brick at him.
Yes.
But another thing about the Fantastic Car is it can split into four parts, and each person can control it. So they've got these wonderful individual hovercrafts, basically, that they can use to scour the city.
That's cool.
So we get the Human Torch fighting the monster as well. The Thing, of course, throws away his helmet, rips off his shirt, and the Human Torch burns the monster, showing that it's just wood and papier-mâché. And
Sue worked so hard on those outfits. Of course she knew how to sew back then.
Yes. The Miracle Man's able to shoot chemical foam at the Human Torch. He's able to make the Thing sink into the ground, and Sue Storm hides. But they're defeated by the Miracle Man in their first round with him, which is kind of a theme in Marvel books as well. Not as much in the Fantastic Four, but really used a lot in Spider-Man, where the first time he fights a villain, he gets defeated. He has to figure out a way to, you know, outthink the villain. And in this one, we're getting the same thing, where, you know, the Fantastic Four are going to have to outthink the Miracle Man. But we get a sequence where we get their origin again. So in the third issue, we get their origin again. And in a lot of books, they would retell the origin quite a few times, because every book is somebody's first.
Yeah. And it had been 6 months since the first issue had been published.
Nope, only four.
Only four. Okay, yeah, that works. Okay.
So issue one, and then 2 months later was issue two, 2 months later is issue three. But, you know, this was also, you couldn't buy back issues. You know, people would write to Marvel asking for back issues at this point. Some comic publishers had them. EC used to keep back issues and would sell them while they were still publishing. Marvel did it from time to time in their early days. Warren, Jim Warren with Creepy and Eerie, he had back issues until he shut down. It wasn't something that they did, but it was done often enough that people would actually write in and ask.
Okay.
But again, we get another fight between the Thing and the Human Torch.
Feels like that was a mandate. They have to pick on each other at least once each issue.
But also, the Thing has to give his speech about how he's, you know, trapped in this monstrous form. Because the Thing is the pathos character. He's the character, you know, everybody else can continue their lives and looks normal, but the Thing is a misshapen freak. And Kirby drew him as a monster back then. Later on, you know, he had a definite look where he kind of, you know, covered with rocks. But here, he just looks like he's got scaly skin.
Mm-hmm.
So they go to find Mr. Miracle again, and the Invisible Girl is, a dog finder. These are not immensely powerful characters at this point.
No, they're not.
You know, they're very much easily taken. Their powers are not that great. They don't know how to use them, you know, story-wise. But it's also, Stan and Jack weren't comfortable with having big superpower-type things go on. Whereas back in the 40s, you know, Submariner drowned all of New York. But note, they're very small scale at this point. So they take on the Miracle Man, who has a key that turns into a gun. They chase the Miracle Man down with a jalopy.
I love it, though. They get the tire gets shot out, and Reed becomes the new tire of the car.
Yes. And when they capture the Miracle Man, the Thing wants to punch him, and Reed stops him because Reed has figured out that it's all hypnotism.
And then we have the Human Torch quitting the team.
Yes.
3 issues into this book, and somebody's quit.
And it's the Thing is still needling him and fighting with him, and Johnny Storm, as a 16-year-old, cannot take it any longer and takes off. This is the first cliffhanger, the first continued story. Think about the fact that most comics didn't even have a story that lasted a full issue. 3rd issue in, and they're doing a continued story. Of course, you don't know it's a continued story. These are new characters. For all we know, the Human Torch is going to take off, and as Reed said, it's not him I'm worried about, it's mankind. For what will we do? What can we do if he should turn against us? Well, the Thing's a monster. He gets attacked and stuff all the time. They can't control him. Human Torch, back in the 40s, he turned rogue often enough. What's going to happen? We don't know. Now, there is a pinup page for the Human Torch, but we get the first letters page.
Please tell me about that. Because, again, I'm reading the Essentials. You have the Omnibus. You have a lot more content that I don't have access to.
It says here, you know, they've got the address. And Stan said that, you know, the Fantastic Four got letters. All of our other books would get, you know, maybe 1 or 2 letters. You know, my book was missing a stable. I want a refund. Or you had the Rawhide Kid holding his gun in his left hand and then in his right hand. I want a refund. In this one, it's letters. But Stan also was known for writing the type of letters he wanted. There is a letter from Alan Weiss, who was actually a comic fan back then, worked in the fanzines, and later worked in comics, drew issues of Warlock.
Okay, by Adam Warlock?
Yeah.
Okay, nice.
The final one here, the final letter. Dear Editor, are you the same one who puts out Strange Tales, Tales to Astonish, Journey into Mystery, Tales of Suspense, Amazing Adult Fantasy, and a lot of Westerns like Kid Colt Outlaw, and teenage titles like Patsy Walker? If so, how do you do it? S. Brodsky, Brooklyn, New York, Stan's answer, of course, with great difficulty.
Because that's Stan.
Stan was already doing the kind of your funny uncle gimmick, which was always part of his bit. Let's see. P.S. We just noticed something. Unlike other collections of letters in different mags, our fans all seem to write well and intelligently. We assume this denotes that our readers are cut above average, and that's the way we like them. Important note. We receive so much mail, it is utterly impossible to engage in correspondence with any readers. As many letters as possible will be answered on this page each issue. Please do not ask us to write to you personally. However, they did have a secretary who would send letters to people.
Really?
Yes.
I love it, though, because...
The fabulous Flo Steinberg.
Oh, I love this, though, because I feel like this is the beginning of things like the Mary Marvel Marching Society and Foom.
Yes.
and Stan's Soapbox and the beginning of making you feel like you're part of the fun of Marvel
Comics.
Yes,
you are part of this club.
Yes.
And issue 4.
Oh, I was excited to read this one because I knew what it was.
And this one actually, to me, is the first one that doesn't have a lot of the goofiness, except, yeah, there's a couple goofy things. But they're getting their feet under them. They're doing more of what I would see as the soap opera part of Marvel, which Stan loved that stuff. Remember, he wrote the teenage soap opera comics in the 50s and even into the 60s. That was his bread and butter. He loved that stuff. But on the cover, we have the Submariner, who was Timely's big star back in the 40s, and the longest running of the hero return stuff in the 50s, and was the character that Martin Goodman said they needed to bring back. Rather than bringing him back as part of the team, nope, he's a villain. And I want to point out some stuff on this cover. First off, everybody's in action except for Sue.
Yes.
And the Thing, look at the Thing. He's not going to attack the Submariner. He's freaked out about his looks.
Yeah.
This is important because you have to remember, in the beginning, the Human Torch was the most popular character. But it wasn't long before the Thing was the most popular character at Marvel. He got Marvel 2-in-1 around the same time as Marvel Team-Up. The Thing made guest appearances. In the 70s, the Thing was a hugely popular character. And in a lot of ways, he was like the way Wolverine became in the 80s and 90s. When you thought of Marvel, you thought of the Thing, a superhero who hates being a superhero, hunted and feared by the outside world.
And he feels very much like a prototype for Wolverine to appear, you know, like,
yes,
13 years later, whenever, 1974, was it, when Wolverine showed up?
74.
So, you know, the berserker rage, the can't be controlled, but he's got, like, this gentle heart still somewhere inside of him.
So the inker on issues 3 and 4 is Sol Brodsky, who wrote the letter in the third issue. Just pointing that
okay.
out. Hey, but we start off picking
Corey,
up
that's
exactly where. But we pick up where we left off, where the Torch is gone, and they have decided they need to go find him, except for the Thing, who, you know, doesn't really think they need to go find him. Screw him. By the way, this is the first time, 3 issues in, the first time, Fantastic Four no more. They didn't say it, but it's, oh, the team is broken up. And this team broke up more often than I've had a hot meal.
To say, how many times has it happened in 645 issues?
Reed isn't putting up with Ben's crap at all. It's your fault he ran off! So we get a recap of the past story. And at the bottom of the page, I don't know if this is in the essential or not, but it says at the bottom of the page, the Hulk is coming.
Which page number?
Page number 2.
Nope, nothing.
But in the original printing, the Hulk is coming. The characters all go in search of the Human Torch. We get a sequence, you know, where they show what happened in the previous issue, and it's the Human Torch using his powers. By the way, at the next page at the top, it says, who is the Hulk? The Hulk is coming. Who is the Hulk?
Somebody send me an omnibus, please.
The Invisible Girl searches the Pop's chocolate shop, basically. And has a soda while invisible because we need to show her powers.
Yes. And searching... are we still in Central City?
We're not given a name, but since the Fantastic Four had their headquarters, retroactively, this was when they moved to New York.
Okay. Searching New York City is hard work. I need a soda, too.
Reed shows his powers by yanking a teenager off his motorcycle to ask where the Human Torch is. Meanwhile, little did they suspect, he's working on cars again and using his power to do some spot welding. Of course, the Thing is the one who finds him. So we're going to get a fight.
I love this, though, because up until this point, all we've seen Johnny do is burst into flames, fly, and melt things.
Also, if you look, he looks very different in this. Previously, he was kind of that glob of flame.
Yeah, and we're now starting to get those recognizable lines, those characteristic lines.
Yes. Which, you know, we saw a little of it the previous issue and on the cover, but now it's much more defined, and it looks more like, you know, a human figure with flame around it, rather than the first two issues where it was, you know, basically a big fireball. But here we get a fight between the Thing and the Human Torch. And it is broken up by the Thing turning back into Ben Grimm, and that sequence at the bottom of page 7. Ugh. I adore that sequence so much. That tells you everything you need to know about the Thing. You know, he's giddy that he's human again, and then he's back to being a monster. Kirby gives him that pose, the woe is me pose.
Yeah, that staring at his hands as he turns back and then collapsing to his knees, crying into his forearm. Oh.
This was not done in other books. Nowhere did Batman go, oh, I'm so sad that my parents are dead. Yeah. It's now my parents died.
At least not for about another 30 years.
It wasn't until the 70s that he started to become really obsessed with it. But this was, you know, the hero was not happy-go-lucky. The hero was tragic. He was a tragic figure. Human Torch ends up on Skid Row with the Bowery Bums. Yeah. And
downtown.
And he finds a beat-up comic from the 40s at this YMCA.
I love that they keep doing this, like bringing back old Marvel comics within the comic.
And, yeah, one of the other bums says, hey, you know, we got a guy here who's as strong as the Submariner. So the next page, this bum with long hair and a beard just beats everybody up. He gets irritated that they're bothering him, beats everybody up. The Human Torch gives him a shave and a haircut with his flame and discovers that he is the Submariner. So the Submariner, since this is the return of one of the timely characters, it's not somebody else in the form like Johnny Storm was for the Human Torch. Nope, this is the actual Submariner. This is a different stylized version because if you read the 40s and 50s version, his head was unbelievably triangular. Kirby makes it still triangular, but more kind of human.
Yeah, he's a little more elfin.
Yes. Yeah. As the Fantastic Four keep looking for him, there's a really nice page on page 11 of Mr. Fantastic looking for him with people still, you know, the Fantastic Four heroes have been in the paper and everything, but people are still kind of freaked out.
I love that first panel on page 11, that shot, that angle. That's just great.
Yes, and, you know, holy smoke, I read about you guys, but I never dreamt you really existed. Also, by the way, if you look, there is another... The Stan Lee and Jack Kirby signatures at the top,
yeah.
And there is another V number.
Yeah, I noticed that throughout these four issues that would still keep popping up. I have not looked ahead to issue 5 to see if it's there, but I know what issue 5 is, and I'm just going to keep quiet because I'm excited to read it.
But number 4, this could have been where it's okay, we've had a few issues, maybe we'll have a backup story, because they're pushing the Hulk.
Okay.
And the Hulk is set up in the same way if you read those issues. It's, you know, the 4-part story. Maybe the Hulk would have been a backup feature in this, but they kept the Fantastic Four as their own book because sales were so good.
I need to
but
read some of those Hulks. I have those essentials as well.
You know, people are still reacting. Holy smoke, I read about you guys, but I never dreamed you really existed. And then, you know, when he says, hey, if you see the Torch, let us know. Mister, the first guy I'll contact will be my eye doctor. And Johnny Storm, by the way, carries the Human Torch, who doesn't know who he is, drops him in the ocean. Being in the ocean, he suddenly realizes that he is the Submariner. His memory returns as well as his strength. He goes to Atlantis, and it has been destroyed, and all of the buildings are radioactive.
Well, Corey, I would think he would have remembered he was the Submariner every time you went to go poop, if he was wearing those trunks underneath that...
Well, yeah, there's a...
Let's not pick it apart that much. Stop, Adam.
Well, we don't need to pick it apart because Roy Thomas would work on that. Okay. Roy Thomas filled in some stuff. Burns filled in some stuff. Roger Stern filled in some stuff. They've went back and filled in, you know, how this could have happened, including, I don't remember who the villain was, but one of the Submariner's villains basically destroyed his mind. Okay. and all that. But he's gone. Atlantis has been destroyed by nuclear testing. So he comes back. Human Torch thinks, hey, cool. But nope. Submariner has said, by returning my memories, you've signed the death warrant of the human race. Revenge. I'm talking about revenge I shall have for the destruction of my undersea kingdom. He is set up as a villain. He's given a reason to be a villain, and it ties in a lot with the stuff from the 40s, where he really didn't much care for the surface people anyway, but now he's got another reason to hate us, because we destroyed his entire civilization. So the Human Torch signals for the Fantastic Four. He fills them in. Meanwhile, the Submariner wakens Giganto.
I love it.
We have another monster.
There's our monster.
He has got a trumpet that can awaken Giganto and make Giganto do whatever he wants. So he's going to send Giganto to attack the surface world.
Do not toot
the
it.
The military. That has been relettered, by the
has
way.
Has it? Yeah, I know.
Yes. But still, yeah. That's from Supervillain Team-Up, I do believe.
Right. I never knew where it came from. It just makes me laugh whenever it pops up on the internet.
But the military can't stop Giganto as he comes to attack New York City. And you got to remember, this was at the height of Godzilla. Yeah, the Godzilla movies were coming. There'd been a knockoff of Godzilla done in England called Giganto. No, Gorgo.
Gorgo.
Which Steve Ditko drew every issue of.
Go get it, kids.
That was published by Carlton. You can pick that up, by the way. You can go over to Amazon or ask your local comic shop. It's available from IDW.
Does the mob still get a cut?
When Carlton went under, they released all copyrights to everything.
Okay.
If you want to print the Gorgo comic series, you can.
Oh, God. And give up that Fatty Boom Batty podcast paycheck?
Hey, if you want to reprint every issue of Baron Werewolf's Haunted Library... You can.
There's an audience out there for it, Corey. I feel it.
They're already reprinting it because there's a lot of Tom Sutton art and a lot of Ditko art.
Damn it.
But you can make your own copy.
Oh, good. I'm going to do that.
Yeah. So the Human Torch, Giganto puts his flame out. No one can stop Giganto.
Oh, yes, they can.
However, he passes out. He passes out, and the Thing straps a nuclear bomb to his back and goes into Giganto's mouth.
Oh, and I love this sequence, Corey. I cannot tell you how much I love this sequence. That Giganto is so large, there are multiple shipwrecks still within his belly.
Yes.
And monsters, smaller monsters inside of the bigger monster.
And the Thing drops the nuclear bomb. Barely makes it out in time. They set off a nuclear bomb inside this giant monster, and it dies kind of belching. Anytime you hear that, oh, we understood the fear of nuclear weapons back in the 50s and 60s, obviously we didn't.
No.
The Submariner still has his horn. He's going to blow it and call forth another monster, and Sue Storm grabs it from him. He captures her, and it is love at first sight in his mind.
Yes.
He's not subtle.
No, he is not. And I love it. I've always loved that, just how much Namor is infatuated with Sue Storm.
But right here, it's, you're the loveliest woman I've ever seen. If you be my bride, I will show mercy to the rest of your pitiful race. She refuses. The fight is about to start again, but the Human Torch creates a whirlwind and deposits Giganto's corpse and the Submariner back in the ocean, where he swears revenge.
And I love this. This is two different uses of the Torch's powers in one issue.
Yes. They're making him more powerful. They're using him more. I also need to figure out where the Strange Tales started, because he is the star of the comic to the point where he gets a solo series really early on. So I need to take a look and see when that started. But we got another letters page. S. Goldberg writes a letter. That's Stan Goldberg, who was drawing Millie the Model, and later went over to Archie and became one of Archie's longest-running artists. And then Jim Mooney, who was drawing Supergirl and did some moonlighting for Stan.
They wrote letters, huh?
They wrote letters. How about the bios of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby? Don't tell me the Fantastic Four are real people and Lee and Kirby are imaginary. That's Jim Mooney's letter. Let's see. Stan Goldberg's was, are you kidding? What kind of super characters are these? They're always fighting amongst themselves. They have the same jealousies and personality clashes as real people. Have you flipped your lids? Do you think comic mag readers are intelligent enough to appreciate all that good writing jazz? If you want my opinion, you're darn right. Stan kind of blowing smoke up his own skirt. But that's what they did. They would write letters in the vein that they wanted. They trained the readers how to write letters so they could get printed.
That's crafty.
If you go into the 70s, the letters pages were crafted to the point where Don McGregor told me that he was told if your comic got too many typewritten letters, you were probably going to get canceled because you weren't selling to kids.
Okay.
You know, here's the fourth issue, and they're really pushing that these characters are different, they're unique, they're more complex, they're more realistic. And that's what you get out of these early issues. Now, you know, we expect that from the Fantastic Four. It's expected. But if you read other comics from the time, they were aimed at kids. The characters were very one-dimensional. Especially over at DC, every story was a puzzle. The hero would figure out the puzzle, and that would be the solution. Here, you see that Stan and Jack are kind of struggling to how to do a superhero story. How do the heroes beat the villains?
Yeah, because the endings of these are not great. Each issue just kind of ends. And it's like, we, as you said earlier in the episode, we have 2 pages left to figure out how to finish this story. What are we going to do?
And how many of it is, and then we ran away? Yeah, we've had 2 stories where the way they beat the villain is, we ran away. You know, the Human Torch, we'll just throw Submariner in the sea. Mole Man, we'll run away.
Please tell me that the next time the Submariner comes back isn't Daredevil 7, where he hires Matt Murdock to sue the human race.
No, the Submariner will show up in our next episode.
Oh, there's some more foreshadowing.
With these 4 issues, my input when I read them from the modern standpoint is that the stories are kind of goofy, they're messy, they're not well structured, but Kirby's art is amazing and the characters are what drives it. The reason I'm reading these stories in the early days is for the characterization. Reed's character, pretty bland at this point. Sue's character, pretty bland at this point. But the Human Torch and the Thing have personality. They pop off the page because they don't act like your standard superheroes. They don't even act like your standard, you know, kid, you know, cartoon heroes or kid movie heroes. These are characters that are more complex. They're more nuanced. And I think it really comes from Stan doing that sort of story in the soap opera comics he did. Whereas, you know, they wanted to make sure that they stayed commercial. Hey, the monster books sell. We got to have a monster. We got to have a monster in these comics.
And I really feel like Torch and Thing are the 2 characters that are going to appeal the most to their target demographic. And Reed and Sue already, at this point, kind of feel like your mom and dad.
Yes.
And you really don't need to know more than that at this point.
And they aren't doing anything. Later on, they develop characterizations, but right now, they're just kind of there as story devices.
Right.
And with Sue, all she can really do is turn invisible. They haven't figured out what to do with that yet.
Oh, but they do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But that's my impression of the first 4 issues. What's your impression as someone who had not read them before?
Like you, you know, the stories were goofy. They're goofy as hell. But definitely, you know, seeing it from 57 years in the future, going back and looking at this, you're seeing the building blocks of what becomes the Marvel Universe starting to show up. The Mole Man, you know, he continues to show up over time. You know, the return of the Submariner, the introduction to the Skrulls, you know, these key players that will continue to show up over the course of the next almost 60 years throughout the Marvel Comics universe, and even starting to see some of this stuff bleed into the MCU at the theater with the Skrulls showing up in Captain Marvel next year. I'm really enjoying this. I mean, sometimes these older books from the 60s, I have a really hard time getting through. And I didn't have that problem with these four issues. I felt like this, even though the stories were goofy, they were written well enough, and the Kirby artwork is so phenomenal that I got through it really quickly. I can see why these books started to get as popular as they were as quickly as they did, and I had a lot of fun reading them. I could see what's going on. There's something magical about these comics.
Yeah, there is. And it was very much, you know, Stan said that, I was leaving comics, so I just decided to do a book I would like. I think there's a little of doing a book that you would like, because if you look through comics, the entire history of comics, anytime people are putting out really great books, when you listen to them talk about what it was like, they'll say, we were doing the kind of stuff we wanted to read.
I would agree with that, because I think I'm reading this and I'm thinking about, you know, things that I have read by Stan and Jack from the 60s, mostly like the X-Men, where to me that was a slog. Like any of those early issues, just reading them, I'm like, this is not that good. It just feels like we needed more comics. Here's the X-Men. Where this, I feel like there was like a lot of, and maybe we're reading into it with just how much we love this stuff, but this feels like it was more than a paycheck.
Yeah. And you could really see that, you know, Kirby had done all sorts of books, but he always liked action. And in this, he was able to really sort of just do action. He didn't have to do a lot of, you know, people standing around talking. And if they were standing around and talking, he could have them doing things to make that talking interesting. And over at DC, if you've read his Challengers of the Unknown, I know that there are people who love that book, but for me, that's the hardest stuff for me to read from Kirby. And I've read his romance stuff, I've read the crime stuff, I've even read Strange World of Your Dreams, where people would send in dreams and Kirby would draw them as stories.
I've never heard of that. That's kind of neat.
But those Challengers of the Unknown, the characters, you could tell that DC was wanting him to draw their house style. Things were more posed, things were more stiff, things weren't as exciting. Look at how he played with panel grids in this. You know, very few pages are the standard grid. He's using a lot of different panel sizes and changes to things. He's got some great sequences here of, you know, even in the Miracle Man story, you know, that page 13 where the Miracle Man's holding a key and the key turns into a machine gun. You've got that nice pop big panel at the top, and down below, you've got the three panels where not much is happening, but it really feels like that story is just moving forward at breakneck speed.
Yes.
So Kirby's storytelling, and it's hard for me to explain to people who don't understand it, but Kirby was the master at getting you to go to the next panel. And at the bottom of the page, getting you to turn that page. He just knew it. He'd done it so much, he just knew it. This was a guy who'd worked in comics for 20 years. He was a master at that time. And his as the Fantastic Four goes on, he reaches peaks that go far beyond what he did in the past.
I'm excited to go on this journey. I know he was on the book for 102 issues.
Yep.
And just to see how this evolves over the time it takes to do those. I listened to your podcast that you do with Joe and just the reverence you have for Kirby. I'm excited to do this with you for that, because I know you're going to bring a lot of that history and that love to the table, where I feel like my contribution is going to be like, that was really cool.
Well, it's also fun because you're seeing these stories for the first time. I've been reading them since the 70s. And you're reading this stuff for the first time, so that's why we've got a really good perspective. And if you have something to say about these first four issues, go ahead and let us know. We've got a phone line, we've got an email address, and we'll drop that right here. The Solitaire Rose Radio Network has all sorts of podcasts. We've got Scrabbling Across the West with Dave Cafell and his lovely bride, Stephanie. They travel across the country playing musical gigs, and at night they sit down to play Scrabble and talk about their day at scrabbling.solitairerose.com. There's Novelcast over at novels.solitairerose.com, where I take the novels that I've written and turn them into audio podcasts. Currently, we are doing a novel called Do the Job, which is a murder mystery set in the world of 1980s professional wrestling. Then, over at badadvice.solitairerose.com, me, Corey Strode, and Wolfie B. Bad, along with Dan Moore, give bad advice to people who send in questions. That's bad advice over at badadvice.solitairerose.com. The Solitaire Rose Radio Network is growing. Be there! You think NBC will get mad I used that? And because, you know, we're part of the Solitaire Rose Radio Network, we're not part of the Fancy Pants Gangsters Network.
No.
Because they're scared of me. They're scared because I'm a national treasure.
He is, and they're scared that I'm going to get my comic book hands all over more of their shows.
So, because it's on the Solitaire Rose Podcast Network, we have ads, and they're right here.
At the end.
Promotional consideration is paid for by the following sponsors. Our first sponsor is DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com has been with us since the beginning. They're the best web host in the whole known universe. And if you need a web host, and you do because, you know, Facebook, Google+, everything gets hacked. But if you set up your own web page, it'll never get hacked. Unless you kind of make some mistakes or pick an easy password like password. But still, you can have your own web page. If you use the code CRAZY, K-R-A-Y-Z, you get $20 off your first year. When you're at the office, do you often run to the vending machine for snacks? Those things are terrible for you. Instead, have snacks delivered to you. So go to graze.com. Graze.com has healthy snacks that you can decide what kind of snacks you want, how often you want them, whether they get delivered to you, or if you choose them every time. I myself get the subscription box every 2 weeks so that I have healthy things to eat when I'm at work. You can get a free box by using the code CORYS3R5P. Matter of fact, use that code your fifth and your first box are free. Again, that's CORYS3R5P. If you'd like to advertise on any of the Solitaire Rose Podcast Network shows, you can. Just send us an email at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. Thanks. Yes.
Not in the middle.
What? No, we're not going to do that like Mark Maron, who puts all his ads at the beginning, so you have to listen to him. But we're going to have fun stuff after the ads, aren't we?
We should.
We'll work
on it. All right.
Well, I want to thank everybody for listening. Adam, I want to thank you for pushing the idea.
Oh, no, thank you for planting the seed. It was just like...
By the way, the next episode will not be over 2 hours.
No, we had to put a little history down for that. But then again, since it is a monthly show, do you really care how long it is? I mean, you got to listen. Maybe you can like break it up into 30-minute chunks you listen to each week. I don't know. Do whatever
you... Or maybe you could just listen to it in the car.
In the car, yeah. Yeah. It's like 4 days of driving to work back and forth. I don't know. I work from home, so I don't know. But yeah, definitely.
We need to come up with a tagline.
We do. We'll figure it out. It's okay. Episode one. And as you saw with issue one of the Fantastic Four, there isn't a Marvel Comics on the cover. It took them 14 issues to do that. It won't take us that long to come up with some funny stuff to say.
And maybe I'll write us some letters.
Yeah. Oh, please do. Mine are all going to start, Dear Fantastic Forecast. I never thought it would happen to me, but...
Well, face front, true believer, we'll be back in 1 month.
Yes, we will.
With more of the Fantastic
Four. Oh, and my favorite villain of all time.
Kurgo?
How did you know?